Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
United Condemnation.
We condemn the government of Israel's plan for 1,600 new housing units in Jerusalem. As I have said before, I say again, directly and without equivocation, settlements are illegal under international law.
The Secretary General of the United Nations could not be more clear. While on the ground in the Middle East, things could hardly be less so. Settlements that settle nothing, non-existent peace talks, and an Israeli government weak and on the defensive. Israel and Palestine, no steps forward, where all paths seem to lead backwards. Looking for the roadmap on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Can it already be St. Patrick's Day?
It is already St. Patrick's Day. Amazing,
Wednesday, March 17th. Good morning, everyone. We're going to talk about the frustrating stalemate, which appears to be moving nowhere in the Middle East this morning.
Exactly. Let's get a check now on the morning's top news. The FBI says confused hitmen may have gone to the wrong party and killed the wrong people in the Mexican city of Juarez last weekend. Three people with ties to the U.S. embassy were killed in the drive-by shooting, we're learning this morning. The FBI says there's no evidence that the victims were targeted because they were employed at the consulate. Meanwhile, Mexican President Felipe Calderón's visit to Juarez yesterday spurred protests from some citizens who demanded the withdrawal of the military. They accused the military of provoking more violence. Here at home, some religious leaders are telling undocumented immigrants not to fill out census forms. The Reverend Miguel Rivera is the chairman of a coalition of about 20,000 churches.
How in the world are we going to ask undocumented immigrants to trust and to open the door where they have no assurances that that information will be confidential? I will not be used against them.
Other religious leaders say that's counterproductive.
We'll have more on the census later on in the program. Back to the Middle East. Israel has lifted its closure on the West Bank this morning, and it comes as the U.S. and Israel seem to be stepping back from their deepest rift in decades. The BBC's Heather Sharp joins us now from Jerusalem. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning.
So how long do Israelis and Palestinians believe this lateral drift we've kind of seen over the last few weeks in the peace process? How long do they think it can go on?
Well, I think what we saw yesterday, we saw clashes on the streets, was a sign that the Palestinians are becoming more and more frustrated. And if you speak to them, they don't have much positive to say about the efforts to restart the peace process. I'm not even going to call it a peace process because essentially there isn't one. On the Israeli side, there's a bit more difference in opinion. Some Israelis think if we want a two-state solution, we really need to move on because demographically we need to have some kind of solution that prevents there being essentially a Palestinian majority one state. They want to divide it to have two states. But on the other hand, there are people who do quite strongly support the strong line that Benjamin Netanyahu has taken on security.
Well, I could hear the frustration trying to figure out who's splitting hairs and where, and the stalemate continues. We're going to explore that in just a few minutes. Heather Sharp, stay with us.
In Iraq, Prime Minister Maliki's Shiite coalition is demanding a recount after the latest results show a Sunni bloc has taken the lead in the popular vote. But al-Maliki's coalition is still projected to win the largest number of seats. And here at home, Health Secretary Kathleen Sebelius says it looks like things are on track for a House vote on health care either Friday or Saturday. Democrats are still appear to be short of the 216 votes they need, though.
The number of people in state prisons, here's a big story, has dropped for the first time in nearly 40 years. It's a small drop. The Pew Center report put the drop at just 0.4%. California and Michigan saw the biggest declines. There are nearly 1.5 million inmates in state prisons across the nation. Let's look at markets. Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up this morning. The Dow will get underway at 10,685. The S&P at 1,159. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,378. Since it is St. Paddy's Day, we're going to talk a little bit about St. Paddy's food, green milkshakes. Sound? Does that ring your bell?
Shamrock shakes. Yay. We're also going to be asking you about how you can help yourself get out of financial straits. And one way you got to do that is by talking about it. Do you have trouble talking about money? What will you not talk about? Maybe it's your salary. Let us know at 8778MYTAKE or thetakeaway.org.
Y
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Well, you know that when New York Times columnist and former Middle East reporter Tom Friedman compares the Israeli government to a drunk driver, which he did responding to the trip by Vice President Biden last week, which, of course, had all kinds of problems, which we'll talk about in a moment. You know that all cannot be well in the Middle East peace process. And did you notice there our colleague, BBC Heather Sharp, won't even call it a peace process.
Right.
There's so little going on. Well, a combination of ill-timed statements on settlements in the occupied territories when Joe Biden was in Jerusalem, there are some scattered demonstrations that we've been hearing about this week, a widespread perception that the entire peace process has ground to an ill-mannered halt, has really raised fears throughout the region that the current stalemate might quickly be replaced by something worse. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, speaking yesterday, tried to make a virtue out of disagreement.
We are both committed to a two-state solution. But that doesn't mean that we're going to agree. We don't agree with any of our international partners on everything.
George Mitchell, the Obama administration's special envoy, is expected to finally arrive in the Middle East this week. Well, to talk about whether this is some sort of a turning point or just a standard issue stalemate in the peace process, we've got Dr. Ian Peleg, a scholar at the Middle East Institute. He's a professor at Lafayette College and editor-in-chief of the journal Israel Studies Forum. Doctor, good morning.
Yes, I'm also the Charles A. Dana Professor of Government and Law at Lafayette College.
Great. Thanks for clearing that up. Heather Sharp is also with us, BBC correspondent in Jerusalem. Dr. Peleg, would you characterize the current rift in U.S.-Israel relations as a historical watershed in any sense? And is this period reminiscent of any other sorts of frustrating stalemate periods that have been a preamble to something worse in Israeli history?
Yes, I think it is a crisis of a sort. I think it goes beyond being an irritant. And I think that you do have to take an historical view of it and realize that you had in the past those kind of crises in the relationship between Israel and the United States. For example, going back all the way to 1956-57, you had the crisis between the Eisenhower administration and the Israeli government following the Sinai campaign. You later on had in 1975 the crisis between the Ford and Kissinger administration and the first Rabin government, known as the reassessment. You had several of those crises in the relationship between Jimmy Carter and the Israeli government.
Indeed.
In the 1970s. And I think that this one is one of those disagreements that are quite sharp.
Dr. Ilan Peleg is a scholar at the Middle East Institute. He's on the line with us from Pennsylvania. Heather Sharp is also with us, BBC correspondent in Jerusalem. How are the Israeli media playing this particular crisis? Are they reminiscent about the 70s? Is this a period that is demoralizing to Israelis? You described a little bit of the reaction earlier.
I think there are certainly people in Israel who are very, very worried about the relationship. There are editorials suggesting that Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, is kind of spectacularly mismanaging this relationship, which is so important to Israel. And it's a time when, for example, we've got the Goldstone report at the UN, when Israel is feeling its need for support in the international community. But equally, there are people who are enraged and who think that the Obama administration has taken quite a strongly anti-Israel line. For example, he's not even visited here. One of his big set-piece speeches in the beginning was a visit to Cairo. He hasn't been as president yet to Jerusalem. So there are some people that think that they're just pushing it a bit far.
Is the administration's focus on the Arab and Islamic world something that has enhanced the political divisions in Israel and is partly perhaps what we're seeing as a consequence of that?
Well, Israel has wide divisions, full stop. And I think perhaps one of the things that's coming out of this is where everybody really sits. And of course, Benjamin Netanyahu is in a right-leaning coalition. He has some really quite far right-wing partners. And I think in a sense, this crisis is kind of pushing him to choose, is he going to continue to stick to the similar kind of line that will go down okay with them, that will keep the coalition together? Or is he going to have to yield in some sense to the pressure from the American administration, which has made it very clear that it wants serious final status negotiations? And, I mean, the tension we've seen recently is largely over Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is, you know, a kind of very central example of the difference between them. For the Palestinians to come and engage in final status negotiations, they need to feel that Jerusalem is at least on the table.
Right.
Benjamin Netanyahu makes it clear he sees the city as Jerusalem's eternal undivided capital.
Heather Sharp, BBC correspondent in Jerusalem. Ilan Peleg, let's talk a little bit more broadly. I mean, the discussions over the last couple of weeks have been about settlements in East Jerusalem, but I'm wondering, based on what Heather Sharp is saying there, is it possible for Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, to deliver any significant breakthrough on the order of what Ariel Sharon might have been capable of doing before he, of course, had his terrible stroke and was out of commission?
Yes, I definitely think it is. I think that he's basically facing the same kind of choice that Helen was talking about, and that indeed Netanyahu himself had to face in the late 1990s when he was prime minister. In other words, on the one hand, he has his commitment to his ideology and indeed the commitment to the structure of his right-wing coalition. On the other hand, he has enormous amount of international pressure, particularly American pressure, and indeed some kind of an international consensus even on the final shape of the settlement between Israelis and Palestinians. So I think that he is really in the hot seat and has to make a choice, and it remains to be seen exactly how he's going to move along.
But Israeli governments have mistimed this in the past, allowing the clock to run out on the Palestinian side and everything dissolves into violence. I mean, that seems to be the big worry here before we go.
Yes, I think that, in fact, you have both governments mishandling very often their commitments. So I think most of the scholarly scholarly community would look at the situation as both sides and not having kept their commitment according to previous peace settlement.
And nobody powerful enough to actually make a deal at this point. Heather Sharp, BBC correspondent in Jerusalem. Dr. Ilan Peleg, scholar at the Middle East Institute and professor at Lafayette College. Thanks to both of you. And at 50 minutes after the hour, let's take a look at some other stories we're following.
There have been clashes between police and opposition supporters in several cities in Iran this morning. The clashes come during traditional celebrations leading up to the Iranian New Year this weekend. Authorities say at least 50 people have been arrested. Attorney General Eric Holder says he thinks Osama bin Laden will never be caught alive. The attorney general was speaking to House Republicans about the issue of where terror suspects should be tried.
The reality is that we will be reading Miranda rights to the corpse of Osama bin Laden. He will never appear in an American courtroom.
Holder rejected criticism from Republican lawmakers who say putting terror suspects on trial in civilian courts is dangerous.
Reports this morning say a Chicago man accused of preparing targets for the 2008 Mumbai attacks plans to change his plea to guilty on some charges. David Coleman Headley will appear in court on Thursday. He pleaded not guilty in January to charges including conspiracy to carry out bomb attacks in India. Finally, floods threaten some parts of the country today. National Weather Service forecaster Bob Orovec says flooding in the Mid-Atlantic region is due to rain, but it's a different story in the Dakotas, Minnesota, and Iowa.
There's not much in the way of precipitation across these areas, but the snow melting has raised the river levels across those areas to flood stage.
In Fargo, North Dakota, volunteers have been laying sandbags near the Red River, which is expected to crest at 20 feet on Sunday. Let's look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, the census is surprising you with its categories.
Didn't know that blacks or African Americans would still be categorized as Negroes.
What are the categories that the census uses, and why do they change? We'll talk about that in a few minutes.
What's your take? Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway, from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Time for some takeouts on stories that we're following this week, and the big one is healthcare, which is supposedly in its endgame stage. But Capitol Hill is now embroiled in a debate over procedure.
They're already uneasy about the way this is playing out. Now you're saying it's going to be this Byzantine procedural rule that nobody understands. You lose the trust of the public at some point. This bill's too big to do it that way.
That's Democratic Congressman Jason Altmyer of Pennsylvania. You lose the trust of the public at some point. I think we may have passed that point already. But right now, the argument is not over the health care bill at this moment. It's over how we get it done. There are those who want a decision and don't care how it happens. To explain, we've got our Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning, Celeste.
So the latest is we're hearing, okay, first of all, we now know as the American public more about reconciliation as a procedure in Washington than anybody ever probably wanted to know.
Right.
But the Byzantine procedure that Jason Altmyer is talking about is not reconciliation. This is a bizarre rule that's going to allow them possibly to pass the health care bill in the House without voting on it. How does that work?
Well, that's right. Reconciliation's involved, but only tangentially. So another twist in this gnarled vine of rules here. Every bill, Celeste, that comes to the House floor comes with what's called a rule. And a rule goes through the gatekeeper of the House Rules Committee. And a rule just says, here's how many hours you get for this debate. Here's how many amendments you get. And then we're going to vote on passing the bill. And every bill that comes to the floor has a rule that governs that. Well, what Democrats are considering having here is a rule that says, once the House votes on this rule, the House will approve the rule. The Senate bill, which a lot of Democrats don't want to vote for a lot of reasons, once they vote on this rule, the Senate bill is automatically passed. Poof. Just like that. You pass the rule, the bill is passed. Another thing they might do, a variation on this, have a rule that says once they vote on the reconciliation package of fixes, which they also have to vote on, which is popular, a lot of people want to support it. Hey, once you vote on the reconciliation package, poof, Senate bill passed automatically without having to actually cast a vote on that Senate bill. That's what they're considering doing, and that's why Democrats like Jason Altmyer, who you just heard from, don't like it. Now, not all Democrats don't like it, but he's one Democrat who doesn't. Frankly, he didn't vote for it the first time, so why would he like it this time?
Well, some Democrats, as I understand, are privately saying that this would be a way for them to vote for the bill without actually having to go on record.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's sort of the point. Listen to Lynn Woolsey. She's a progressive Democrat from California. She's for this bill, sort of articulating that yes, we just have to get this done, and protecting Democrats from what's potentially an unpopular vote is okay. Listen to Woolsey.
I can tell you that my constituents aren't going to fault me for taking a step that has to be taken in order to get the Senate bill fixed if we have to vote for it first.
It sounds to me like there's just kind of an acknowledgement that the American public just wants this to be done, one way or the other, right?
Well,
they want
that's
this debate to be over.
And that's what a lot of the progressives say. And they frankly say, look, this has been hard enough. There's a lot of stuff in that Senate bill, you know, special deals for Nebraska that are going to come out anyway. But they don't want to have to cast a vote for it because they know what the 30-second ad is going to look like.
Right.
Celeste Headlee voted for special deals, it'll never be in the final bill. So they just don't want to deal with that stuff. And they don't want to vote for a bill that's going to do that to them. So they're looking for a way to be shielded. The House Democratic leadership hasn't made a final decision on this gnarled procedure that we're talking about, but they're leaning towards it because without it, Celeste, it's possible they don't have the votes.
All right. Thanks so much. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent.
I'm thinking about that gnarled vine of rules there Todd talked about. Our next guest is Tim Olson. He's the Assistant Division Chief with the U.S. Census Bureau. He runs the Bureau's outreach campaign nationwide. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, John. How are you?
Great. We asked you on the program because we have a few questions about the categories that you see in the questionnaire there on the census, and all of you playing at home can bring up that questionnaire on the internet if you just go to the census or Google the census. But here's a question somebody had.
This is Michelle calling from Atlanta. Got my census information. It was a little unclear. I didn't know that blacks or African Americans would still be categorized as Negroes. Just kind of disturbed me. What's up with that?
What's up with that, Tim Olson?
we've heard this from many people. It's Negro is just part of the overall category on the form. This is black. African American or Negro. It's just a broad category that people can check off. It's really, when you look back at Census 2000, more than 50,000 people actually wrote in Negro.
Interesting.
And it was one option. Then we continued that for 2010. And if people are upset this time, the best thing I can say is just be sure to check off the race that best fits them. And 2020, it might be different.
Well, figuring out a name to call yourself is also an issue with same-sex couples or heterosexual married couples. And this is the first time the census is actually going to count gay couples, even though they don't have a category called gay couples, right?
Correct.
How does that work?
What'll happen is on every form, there's a person one. And then if there's more than one person in the household, those additional people will identify how they're related to person one. So if you have a household, two people, let's say two women, and person two says that they are related to person one, either as a married partner or as an unmarried partner, husband, wife, or unmarried partner, we will be able to actually tabulate that data and show how many same-sex couples there are in the United States.
In 2000, how many did you count?
1.2 million.
And they were in 97% of all counties within the United States. That's interesting.
Yes.
Now, you can't tell roomies from actual same-sex couples, though, right?
Correct. I mean, roommates is one of the categories on the form. Boarders, children, grandparents. There's many options for how people can be related to person one.
And I just love how interesting it is that every 10 years you have to re-examine the categories. Tim Olson, Assistant Division Chief with the U.S. Census Bureau. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
It's the big question on everyone's minds right now, John. You think it's about healthcare? No, it's not about healthcare. You think it's about, are you wearing green because of St. Patrick's Day? No.
And I'm not.
It's not. It's about who have you picked for the Sweet 16 and the Final Four? Who have you picked to win it all in March Madness?
I'm kind of out of this whole brackets thing. I love the tournament, but I just hate the gambling part. But I know everybody else in the universe.
I love the gambling part if I ever win, which I don't. Mm. So I'm bitter about that. We're going to be talking about March Madness in a moment.
Well.
But first, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. Undocumented immigrants are getting conflicting advice from church leaders on whether to fill out census forms. The Reverend Miguel Rivera, the chairman of a coalition of 20,000 churches, says he's telling them not to fill out the forms until the government promises not to use the information against them.
I got information from our regional vice presidents that confirmed me that between 3 million to 3.5 million members of our churches will not participate in the census.
Others like Reverend Samuel Rodriguez say that an idea is counterproductive.
If we boycott the census, we're boycotting representation, number one. Number two, we are boycotting funds and resources for better schools, more police officers, community development.
Census forms began arriving in mailboxes across the country this week. The Pentagon is trying to curb the abuse of painkillers by soldiers. Military doctors wrote almost 4 million prescriptions for painkillers last year. That's more than four times the doses handed out in 2001. Military officials say the increase in pain medication reflects the continuing toll of fighting two major wars.
This story is incredible. Painkillers were the target of a heist in Hartford, Connecticut. They cut a hole in the roof of a warehouse, these robbers did. It's an Eli Lilly facility. They rappelled inside and stole $75 million worth of prescription medications. Experts describe it as one of the biggest pharmaceutical heists in history. There's been a revised estimate of how much money is needed to rebuild Haiti. The Haitian government and international aid agencies say the price tag will be $11.5 billion. There's a donor conference in New York at the end of the month to raise the money. And Federal Reserve Board Chairman Ben Bernanke is standing up for his agency today. It comes after recent financial overhaul proposals from Senator Christopher Dodd threatened to strip the Fed of some of its powers. Bernanke will make his case at a House hearing this morning. Let's check the markets. Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up, so Wall Street will get underway positively when the Dow starts at 10,685 this morning. The S&P opens at 1,159, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,378. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
It's that time of the year again. No, no, not spring, not St. Patrick's Day. It's March Madness.
This year, we watched every game, read box scores, tracked injuries. This isn't March Madness. This is March meticulously thought outness.
Your team lost 20 minutes ago.
That's from CBS's How I Met Your Mother. And like them, many people, both the guessers and the meticulous strategist, will be handing in their filled out brackets for the NCAA men's basketball tournament today. It kicks off with the BYU versus Florida at 12:20 Eastern. Lots of people are flocking towards Las Vegas, not to see a game, but because it's actually illegal to gamble in your office pool, my friends. If you need some tips, though, as you're making your last minute decisions on your brackets, we're joined now by Dan Shanoff. He's a freelance sports writer and a contributor to SportingNews.com and The Wall Street Journal. And another person is here also, Mike Hyland. He's an engineer, and he is headed to Las Vegas tonight for his annual pilgrimage in honor of March Madness. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Mike, not a very good line for you as you are getting ready to preparing to head off to Las Vegas, but you make an annual trip to Las Vegas, and as I understand, you crunch numbers obsessively, stare at boards until you get your brackets filled out and you're ready to gamble on your Sweet 16 and Final Four picks.
Yeah, sure. For about the last 12 years, we've been heading to Las Vegas, a group of my college buddies and I. The brackets are being filled out, you know, a couple days beforehand for all your office pools and friend pools. And then once you arrive in Vegas, really you're sitting in front of these 20-foot projection televisions watching four games at once, betting on between, you know, one and 10 straight bets per game. So you got 16 games going on the first day, 16 games the second day, and then 8 each on the Saturday and Sunday.
And how accurate have you been?
Oh, you know, to really make money in Las Vegas on sports betting, you really only have to get it about a 60-65% clip. I'd say in a good year, I've been up around 80, and some years I've been down around 40.
So you're an engineer. Do you actually just crunch numbers to get the probabilities and the odds, or do you kind of get emotional about some teams?
Well, emotions certainly play into it sometimes. Generally speaking, you want to try to avoid teams that you have an emotional interest in. You know, I wouldn't say that I crunch the numbers specifically, but there's kind of a gut evaluation that takes place between the overall odds, say a money line wager versus a point spread for a particular game. You get to understand what those numbers should look like on paper, and when there's a little bit of an askew line on the board. Because, you know, Vegas is just taking a 10% cut of all the winning bets. So sometimes you'll actually be able to take advantage of a line that's a little bit off.
Okay, so let's go to Dan Shanoff, freelance sports writer. Dan, very often people do go with their gut in terms of turning out their brackets and turning them in. So can you give us kind of some educated advice on how to fill these brackets out and balance the numbers with our gut feelings?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I would be a cautionary tale for the gut. Last year, I went with my gut and finished in the 20th percentile in my bracket in my pool. But I have learned from the experience, and so here's at least one big piece of advice. Pay attention to the crowd. Right? There's all these aggregators out there that will kind of crunch, to the extent they will crunch the numbers of what everyone is picking, right? And so you get a nice wisdom of the crowd factor going, and what the crowd is saying is that Kansas is going to win the tournament, and they're the top-seeded team going into the tournament, and that they're going to beat Kentucky in the championship game, and Kentucky is the second-best team in the tournament. And at some point, the combination of the selection committee's seeding of the entire bracket and what everyone around you is thinking and saying should factor into kind of, you know, what will probably happen. And if last year is any indication, where North Carolina, the best team in the country and the top-seeded team heading into the tournament, rolled its way to the championship, it's a pretty good indicator if your goal is to get the champion right.
But Dan, there's always got to be a Gonzaga out there, right? There's always a Cinderella
team. That's my
team.
Hey, come on. Gonzaga's mine.
See, this is what I'm saying.
Absolutely, and so you definitely want to sprinkle your bracket with a couple of upsets. And traditionally, the classic upset is the fifth seeded team losing to the 12th seeded team. And this year, there's actually of the four matchups, there are three that I think most fans are eyeing and thinking could be have some upset potential. One is Texas El Paso over Butler, Cornell over Temple, and Utah State over Texas A&M. For whatever reason, the 12th seeded team ends up being a little bit stronger than their seed would suggest.
Mike, are you looking at those games?
Well, yeah, sure. You got to be a little bit careful. You know, in Vegas, we're doing a lot of straight wagering on the individual contests, but when you're filling out your bracket,
okay,
you know, you'll be in some pools where the seed multiplier per round makes a business case for choosing those.
Okay, but. But, Mike, what's it come down to? Who are your final four?
Well, the final four, typically, last few years, has just been chalk.
No, I want to know your picks. Who do you have picked for the final four?
Well, Duke's got an easy road, so I'm in there. I like Kansas coming out of their bracket. And I've got some surprises for the 2-seed and the 3-seed coming out of the other bracket.
He's being cagey. Dan, who are your picks?
Kansas, Kentucky, Syracuse. And my one non-one Final Four team is Villanova.
You are a brilliant man. Those are mine as well. That's why I think you're so smart. Dan Chanoff, freelance sports writer, contributor to both the Wall Street Journal and SportingNews.com. And Mike Hyland, getting ready to go to Las Vegas, an engineer.
He's hardcore. Up until just a few weeks ago, it was the case that people thought Pope Benedict, who used to be Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, the Archbishop of Munich, was actually an aggressive sort of fighter and attempting to address the issue of the sex scandals that have plagued the Catholic Church really for decades. But all that has changed in just the last few weeks. David Willey joins us now, BBC correspondent in Rome. Pope himself is actually accused of possibly favoring or overlooking the sex abuse charges against a priest in Munich while he was archbishop. Is it fair to say that the Vatican is viewing these allegations and the way this is being played in the press as something of a crisis?
I think they realize it's a very serious crisis, but of course the Vatican is making encouraging noises all the time, saying that this is only a very tiny minority involved in sexual abuse, and that most priests are upright and God-fearing people who carry out the work of the Church faithfully throughout their whole lifetime. The problem is that in Germany the press has been digging into the record of what Cardinal Ratzinger, as he then was doing when he was Archbishop of Munich, and he obviously has people there who are taking the rap for him at the moment. The Pope is not personally involved in any wrongdoing, as far as we can gather. However, it happened on his watch, and as local Archbishop, he was ultimately responsible for dealing with these cases in his own diocese, and it's extraordinary that the priest concerned has only actually been suspended this week.
Well, that's the interesting point, because the fact that this particular priest, his name was Father Peter Hullermann, we understand, Hullermann, he was still working in the church as recently as yesterday until he was suspended, which leads me to believe that the hierarchy within the Catholic Church is orchestrating this.
Well, the innuendo is that not only in Germany, but in America and in Ireland and in all the countries where sexual abuse has been reported, the Church has been applying double standards. I think the problem is that there is a church law, ecclesiastical law, called canon law, and there is the law of the confession. So when ecclesiastical authorities find out about these cases of sexual abuse of minors by priests, instead of informing the police, they tend to think, first of all, about protecting the good name of the Church. And this, I think, has led to this disastrous policy in recent years, the fruits of which we're now seeing in Rome this week.
I'm wondering if one of the consequences, and the Pope, we understand, is under some pressure to actually speak out on this scandal. We don't know if he will. But does this accelerate the power shift in the Catholic Church away from European congregations and constituencies and more towards Latin America and Africa?
Well, this is, of course, a trend. It's very interesting. In this year's Vatican yearbook, for the first time, they give the numbers of the priests worldwide. And the priests in Latin America and Africa now are slightly outnumbered those in the developed world, in Europe and in North America. So clearly there is a shift going on here, a very important, the tectonic plates, as it were, are moving. And I think this is all part of the story. But of course, insofar as the sexual abuse scandal is concerned, it is a very serious matter.
Right.
The Pope has already been preparing these during these days.
Well, we'll definitely be following it. The Pope crisis. David Willey, one of the most experienced Vatican reporters, BBC correspondent in Rome.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. So you got your Wednesday takeaway food segment, right? You got your St. Patty's Day, right? You
right.
Throw them all in the blender. What do you get?
Welcome back. Hello, spring. Come on, let's celebrate with McDonald's thick, rich, also creamy, great green shamrock shake.
Yes, indeed. They are available at some McDonald's around the world today for St. Patrick's Day. It's a green milkshake, and we're going to talk about what's actually in it and how it actually doesn't taste like Pepto-Bismol. Here's the leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour, though. In Iraq, Prime Minister Maliki's Shiite coalition is demanding a recount after the latest results show a Sunni bloc has taken the lead in the popular vote. Maliki's coalition is still projected to win the largest number of seats in parliament. The U.S. and Israel are trying to heal their worst rift in years. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said U.S. and Israeli officials are now in intense talks about resuming peace talks with the Palestinians. Meanwhile, Chief Palestinian negotiator Saab Arafat says,
"De-confliction and de-escalation are what's needed from the international community now, and this can be attended to only by having the Prime Minister of Israel stop such provocative and such fait accompli policies."
Principally, tensions remain high over settlement plans by Israel in disputed East Jerusalem.
The currency fight between the U.S. and China is heating up. Earlier this week, Chinese leaders said they opposed any country that would force China to change the value of its currency. But yesterday, there's a new twist. The Senate proposed a bill that could force the currency value to rise. To explain, we've got from Shanghai, the BBC correspondent Chris Hogg. Good morning, Chris.
Morning.
So explain to me what exactly is going on. What are these maneuvers and what do they mean?
Well, on the one hand, you've got U.S. politicians appealing to the White House, saying it's very important that in mid-April, President Obama labels China a currency manipulator and saying that unless this produces some kind of change from the Chinese, then some kind of tariffs should be slapped on Chinese goods to help make them more expensive, if you like, and make it easier for American goods to compete. Some people, they will regard this as a nuclear option, if you like, because it would lead to, if it was passed, it would lead to, or if the White House acted on it, it could lead to the opening skirmishes in a trade war.
And how has the international banking community weighed in on this?
Well, it's interesting. We've heard from Dominique Strauss-Kahn. He's the managing director of the IMF. He's been speaking in Europe today. He has come in and said the yuan is very much undervalued, and it is in the logic of rebalancing the economy, the world economy, to allow it to appreciate. So he's coming in on the same side as those American lawmakers. But from China, they've just hit back, the Commerce Ministry, saying focusing on the yuan would not solve trade problems. And they came up with this one suggestion. They say the U.S. could lift exports by lifting its ban on exports of high-tech products. So no suggestion from China that they're going to cave in on this one.
And no glimmer of hope that there's going to be any kind of reconciliation point.
I think it's going to be almost impossible, because they would lose so much face if they did this now. And in this country, as you know, losing face is something, especially in the government, that you don't want to offer your opponents.
Okay, BBC Shanghai correspondent Chris Hogg. In Thailand, in a symbolic act, anti-government protesters have shaken bags of their own blood over the walls of the prime minister's home. They're demanding his resignation. This is the fourth day of protest. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
Guess what's up? Put the food on my plate. Add some coke in my cup. All you can eat.
Okay, so it's Foodie Wednesday here on The Takeaway. It's also St. Patrick's Day, and no one today is going to accuse us of cuisine snobbery, that's for sure. Because there are certain food rituals associated with St. Patrick's Day that are deeply beloved. And let's get the category straight, first of all. I mean, there's going to be lots of people who get out the green food coloring to tweak the cupcakes, to tint the cookies, to lime the jello, to make verdant all that rice, and maybe turn their Guinness green. But there is one sweet celebratory concoction that possibly wins the crowd pleaser award on this day, and that's the McDonald's Shamrock Shake. And Kyra Kyles, you're a fan, right?
Yes, I am a huge fan.
A huge fan. And Kevin Sturtz, you are also a fan of the Shamrock Shake?
That is correct.
All right. Kevin Sturtz is the publisher of TheAmazingServiceGuy.com, a business and customer loyalty specialist, and he's written about the Shamrock Shake's success as a product. And Kyra Kyles is a writer for the Tribune Red Eye in Chicago. And, you know, some people have described you as the biggest Shamrock Shake fan in the world. That doesn't refer to your girth or anything, does it?
Not at all. I have also been referred to as borderline obsessive, but I wear the badge proudly. I love those shakes.
Now, first, let's talk about the mystery of the shakes. They are available at McDonald's, and presumably, Kevin, they're a successful product, but all McDonald's don't have them. First of all, Kevin, why is that?
You know, I believe the reason all McDonald's don't have them is because it's a seasonal product. Sort of one of the strengths is also a weakness in the eyes of, say, the typical owner of a McDonald's. They feel like, oh, it's only here for a month. We've got to buy extra supplies. We've got to train people on it. Maybe it's just not worth it for that small period of time.
All right, so they're slightly hard to find, and you got to find that McDonald's franchise owner that's really into this sort of thing. Kyra, what do you believe is in a Shamrock Shake?
Well, you know, I've actually been trying to figure it out because, sadly, this year I found that in the Chicago market, at least, they're not as minty as they used to be. So I have been trying to figure out what is the exact mint formulation that's in there. And it's also been less green this year. It might also be because they're serving it in a clear cup now, so you can really get a good look at the shake. And it looks kind of pale. So some of my Shamrock Shake finders and I have been trying to figure out some alternatives because we haven't been loving the shake that we have here in Chicago as much.
Now, Kyra, you know, from my standpoint, okay, it seems to me that the Shamrock Shake is a huge risk for McDonald's, and I want to get Kevin's opinion on this, because, you know, a minty, thick drink, I'm thinking Pepto-Bismol. I'm not thinking dessert. And that, anytime you do something minty like that, you're going to remind people of something that you would not want people drinking milkshakes to be reminded of.
Rango mint melted, and that might be something that's really familiar to the Chicago area. At Macy's, Marshall Field's, we used to have Rango mints, and everyone likes them. And that might also be why they're not available throughout the country, is because it is this taste that maybe just some markets really like, but I love it. I think it tastes like I said, more of a Rango mint melted down than anything else.
And Rango mints, boy, that's a blast from the past, talking about the Chicago Rango mints. Kevin Sturtz, what do you attribute the success why is the product successful?
You know, John, I think it's successful because they did a couple of things very well. They, for one thing, it's green, like you point out, but it's a fun green. It's a friendly green. We don't have a lot of green food, as you know, especially, and they market it to kids. So by tying it to a holiday, that's kind of a fun holiday. It's the springtime. It's the time of rebirth and renewal. And they tied it to leprechauns. So how can you go wrong with a fun little leprechaun character carrying around your green minty shamrock shake?
So look, you're the expert, Kevin. Seaweed green, that's not a fun green. Salad green, not a fun green.
You know, I think if you're a kid, the minty, cool, creamy Shamrock Shake, I think it beats it. Plus, think of how fun it is to say it, John. I can't even say it this morning. But with the alliteration, Shamrock Shake. See, there's nothing that's not fun about a Shamrock Shake.
I'll tell you what's not fun about a Shamrock Shake, trying to find a McDonald's that serves them.
Yeah, well, you had some trouble here in
New
Jersey.
I did. I was trying to bring them in last night so we'd have them this morning to you know, during this discussion of Shamrock Shakes. I drove for a while and couldn't get a McDonald's that had them.
Well, we often end these segments with recipes. Kyra, it sounds like your concern about the paleness this year and the lack of mintiness. Have you tried to make a Shamrock Shake on your own?
You know what? I'm going to try to do that on my blog and do like a video demonstration. Someone told me that if you take a fourth or a half teaspoon of mint extract. You can add 5 drops of green food coloring, and you will get an approximation and use the vanilla shake that McDonald's sells. So I'm going to try that. And then I also had one of my fellow bloggers develop a vegan version for people who don't drink dairy. And I tried that, and we're going to unveil that tomorrow on my site at redeyechicago.com /Kyle's file.
Well, good luck to both of you. Kyra Kyles, a writer for the Tribune Red Eye blog in Chicago, and Kevin Sturtz, publisher of AmazingServiceGuide.com, talking about the Shamrock Shake. Thanks to you both.
I'm actually going to try making one of these Shamrock Shakes at home, and we have on our website, thetakeaway.org, a simple recipe on how to make your own Shamrock Shake, since I couldn't find one.
Kyra's like little booster.
I know.
You take that into the McDonald's and it boosts your Shamrock
Shake. And while you're drinking your Shamrock Shake, you can fill out your March Madness brackets. And also at thetakeaway.org, we have your tips on March Madness. We've got Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen's brackets there, and I'm going to post mine up there as well.
Mine will not be there.
No. Those are all at thetakeaway.org. But we've also been getting your personal reactions to the census and some of the surprising categories that are there or maybe aren't there. We did have one listener tell us, I always answer the race question. I check the other box and then write in human. Accurate, truthful, and legal. So we've got more of your census stories at thetakeaway.org as well.
In America, you have to write in human. I love that. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.